Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. My name is Lauren and I'm co-hosting today with Tracy, who is a colleague of mine from York University. For people who want to contact Animal Voices, you can write us anytime about anything to do with the show, really. If you have suggestions for upcoming shows or something you think you'd like to tell us about, you can write us at animalvoices, it's all one word, at CIUT.FM. And today we are having a very excellent interview, I think, but there's just so much to cover, I'm realizing. I have a couple of friends in here who are telling me that we're probably trying to get too much into the second half of the interview, talking about capitalism, literature, and the gays and all that sort of thing. But for people who are just tuning in now, we're talking with Randy Malamud, who's the author of a book called Reading Zoos, Representations of Animals in Captivity. And if this has sparked your interest at all, I would definitely suggest going and purchasing the book. It's really a fantastic read and probably challenge you as it did me. So thanks for being on the show today, Randy.
Thank you.
We heard during the break a song by Simon and Garfunkel called At the Zoo, which I didn't know that I knew, but I do know. And it's actually making me think one of my friends here who helped with the music today came up with a lot of zoo-related music, which actually probably isn't surprising for you, considering it seems that zoos and zoo metaphors and animals and zoo and what they signify is actually pretty pervasive in
yep.
the culture as a way of talking about human experience too.
Yep.
And it's interesting in that song they go through and they talk about different types of animals and who they are and what they represent. So maybe we could take that as just a starting point. What do animals represent to us in the zoo?
Animals represent whatever we want them to represent.
Hmm.
You know, zebras are reactionaries, antelopes are missionaries. You know, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, I don't want to come down too hard on Paul Simon because I love him.
Yeah.
But, I think he's doing a very nice job of showing, you know, and he's trying to be sarcastic, but showing how we can put just whatever imagery, whatever symbolism, whatever metaphors we want on these animals, and there's not much they can do about it. They just sort of have to sit there and take it
mm-hmm.
and carry the burden of representing whatever we want them to, whatever, you know. It betrays, I think, a kind of ignorance on our part, you know, that we don't really try to understand who these animals really are, what they're really like, what characteristics they really have. We just, you know, it's another convenience for us. We want teddy bears. We want sports teams named Rams and Eagles. We, you know, we have our own human culture, and then we try to overlay that on the animals, really heedless to how they might feel about this, or how it exploits them, or how it misrepresents them in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you think about, you know, the type about zoos. But, you know, for one person, zoo animals might represent, you know, this feeling of power. They might get a sense of domination or even satisfaction from seeing another animal confined. If I were at the zoo as a little person, to me, I identified with the animals what I perceived as sadness. I felt identified with their lack of power. And for me, it was a very sad and sort of a pathetic place to be. And so we'll talk hopefully more about the role of children, but I'm curious if you talk about that in your book about how different people perceive. Do you find that maybe people who are more marginalized might read the zoo differently than somebody who's in a position of power, for
yes,
example?
Yes, absolutely. I have a whole section on kids in zoos and also a smaller section on women in zoos.
Mm-hmm.
And I found just a handful of real interesting depictions of women and sort of heterosexual oppression at the zoo. A poem by E.E. Cummings and a story by a lesser-known Italian short story writer, and a couple other things with very similar plots where a man and a woman would go on a date to the zoo, and the man would get all sort of trumped up and puffed up and sexually aroused and sexually aggressive, in some way inspired by you know, by the animals and their, you know, their bravado and so forth, and the women would consciously or unconsciously feel a kind of disempowerment, a kind of threat, and just as you say, I mean, they would in some way identify with the animals. I have a wonderful series of poems. This is one of my favorite things in the whole book, where I talk about two zoo poems, one by Sylvia Plath and one by her husband Ted Hughes. And Ted Hughes loves the zoo, and he goes to the zoo, and he sees an animal in its cage, and he thinks, this is such a great experience for me to be outside the cage and the animal to be inside. And what he figuratively says is, I'm sucking all the power out of the animal, that I prosper because the animal is caged and disempowered.
Mm.
And Sylvia Plath, his wife, who wrote a lot of poetry about the exploitation that she felt from her husband and the sort of general disempowerment that she felt in society, she has a zoo poem called Zookeeper's Wife, in which Ted Hughes, her husband, is sort of metaphorically the zookeeper, and she identifies tremendously painfully with the captivity and the sort of the just inauthenticity of these animals' lives in the zoo.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yes, I have several interesting examples of how men and women, you know, people who perceive themselves empowered and disempowered, react to the same experience at the zoo. And I have a whole chapter on kids at the zoo, and it's mostly sort of autobiographical writings of people like E.L. Doctorow and, you know, and several others about memories of being taken to the zoo as a child, several from Roddy Doyle. And in these passages, you know, just as you say about your own memories of going to the zoo and empathizing, the kids are very perceptive about things, small but obvious things, that the adults miss or the adults choose not to see, about the displeasure that the animals are suffering, and the mangy fur and the self-maceration, that sort of thing. I think that kids at the zoo tend to look much more sort of eye to eye, you know, directly at the animal, whereas I hypothesize that adults go there, you know, sort of with a puffed up sense of themselves and their importance and their, you know, ability to manipulate nature as demonstrated in the zoo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you look at the animal straight on, as kids tend to do, that they are much more likely to become depressed or traumatized,
mm-hmm,
by what they see.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to this idea of animals as metaphors, and
mm-hmm,
as you had pointed out right after the break, that we pretty much can put anything onto animals, and it just, you know, I don't contest that point at all, but my concern when thinking about animals as metaphors, and my frustration, not with this text, but with people that will use animals to illustrate other things that humans are going through, is that sometimes I feel like the materiality, so the actual ways that animals experience their lives in settings such as zoos, gets lost.
Yep.
So animals suffer, and they suffer terribly, and they're often abused in zoos, and they're taken, as you said before, from their context, and then they serve as a metaphor to illustrate perhaps my own suffering without a recognition or any kind of move or a desire to change their actuality.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about how metaphors work in our culture?
That's another big question.
Sorry.
Can we get an extra hour?
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah. How metaphors work. I mean, we see things as symbolic representations of our own emotions, of our own experiences, you know, and so those are then made to be, you know, central. I mean, what's most important is my pain. You know, it's all about me. It's the heat generation. It's all about me. And other things in this world exist as, you know, to the extent that, or they're important to the extent that they can help elucidate my condition, my centrality. And I think that is a very ecologically dangerous attitude. You know, from an ecological perspective, I matter in the environment, and bugs matter in the environment, and water matters in the environment. You know, we're all tied in this together. So I don't think that nature is inherently metaphorical, or that nature inherently lends itself to metaphor. I think metaphor is in some way counter to the larger natural forces that we should be recognizing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I read a lot of nature poetry and a lot of animal poetry, and a large percentage of it, you know, 85, 90, 95% of it, I find offensive in some way, precisely because it exploits nature. The poet is going out, or the writer is going out into nature, consciously or subconsciously asking, what can you do for me? How can how can a walk in the woods help me, get my stuff together? William Wordsworth is possibly, you know, the epitome of this attitude when he talks in Tintern Abbey about going out into nature, and the function of this excursion is to soak up lots of good, calm, natural feelings for when I have to go back to the city and things are all tense and stressful, and, you know, I can then draw on the experience that I had in nature. But all of this is at the expense of a real, authentic, interactive experience with nature. I'm very interested and very concerned with the way people think about animals. I think it's an important thing to do, a tremendously important thing to do, and I wish that there were ways to do it that didn't involve the constraint of the animal, the exploitation of the animal, the proximity of the animal. As I've said before, you know, I just don't think we're meant to be near these animals. I think that in the times when zoos were rarer in the 19th and even in the 18th and 17th centuries, when people didn't have the sort of copious immediate exposure to animal, I think that they had a kind of richer way of imagining who animals were and what animals were. And sometimes their ideas about animals were very wrong. You know, Durer has a famous etching of a rhinoceros from the 16th century, and he never saw a rhinoceros. He read about other people who had seen rhinoceri, and so he drew this rhinoceros, and, you know, he has horns coming out in the wrong places and skin that doesn't look like what the animal really is. But nevertheless, in some ways, I think it's a much more desirable sort of imaginative connection with, you know, what he thinks rhinoceros might be like. And I think this sort of acknowledgement of not knowing, or imaginative leap that we would have to take to get to know these animals if we didn't have them, you know, in these theme parks all around us, I think that would lend itself to a much richer relationship with animals. I think what I would call the metaphorical exploitation of animals typifies the way we suck animals dry. We grind up their bones to use in potions because we think they're aphrodisiacs. We do amazingly perverse things to animals. And I think this all comes out of the same kind of mindset that's fostered in the zoo, that they're there for the taking. You know, that if we have the power to take them from where they live to, you know, to where we want them to be, that there are all sorts of exploitative consequences of this sort of thing, and that's what we do, you know, rampantly in our culture.
It, you know, and in some ways too, I know there's a professor I was working with, her name is Connie Russell. She does stuff on whale watching, and she talks a bit in her work about desire, and I want to tie this into cities and capitalism and a whole bunch of different issues, but it seems as the world continually gets more urbanized and people don't have access in the same way to wildlife because they're living in an urban jungle, a concrete jungle, where perhaps the only wildlife you're going to see is a pigeon, which is considered, you know, a pest. So cities sometimes erode what might be considered this a positive desire to get to know the other, to commune with the non-human, to, you know, be a part, to recognize your interconnectivity with the rest of the world. This might make sense on an ecological level to want to do this. Then zoos step in and say, this is how you can do it, right? And so I wonder sometimes as the world becomes more urbanized, as capitalism continues to gain force and, you know, these wild places, these natural places are eroded, if it works to actually help prop up zoos and the justification for zoos.
Yes, I think it does. I think that zoos are sort of Band-Aid patches to our ecological consciousness and our ecological needs. You know, E.O. Wilson writes in his theories about biophilia that people have these sort of innate needs to connect with animal in some way, and if we can't get it one way, we'll get it another way. And so, sure, I think that zoos can satisfy this, you know, in a very sort of unfortunate kind of way. But, you know, absolutely. I mean, I think that when zoos talk about, you know, the dire realities of disappearing habitats and so forth, what they're saying is that zoos are all the more important. You know, the bamboo forests are disappearing in China, so come see a panda bear here, you know, in my zoo. And the extent to which the zoos present themselves, you know, I mentioned before the sort of Noah's Ark metaphor, or just this idea of an oasis, you know, may be appealing in the short term because it allows us to sort of repress the reality of what we, as, you know, as a Western capitalist industrial society, are doing to the rest of the world, exploiting it and necessitating the destruction of the rainforest so that, you know, more cows can graze so we can have more hamburgers and so forth. You know, as I say, it's just a Band-Aid fix. I mean, they will, the animals cannot survive indefinitely in the zoo. The thing about Noah's Ark, which is a very interesting, you know, story in terms of the way people relate to animals, the way the story is constructed is that the people took the animals onto the ark and took care of them for a limited amount of time, and then let them go, you know, and they went back into society and back into their habitats and prospered. And when zoos sort of abrogate that Noah's Ark imagery, it disturbs me because, you know, the end of the story is missing. There's no place for us to put them back. The habitats are all being destroyed, and the zoos can, the animals cannot survive in zoos indefinitely. I mean, they, you know, if they mate with each other and breed with each other in zoos, then they'll have, you know, terrible gene pools in two or three generations, and so, you know, there's a much larger ecological picture out there that zoos are not allowing us to focus in on.
Randy, I'm going to have to interrupt you for a second. We have 3 minutes left. This has been an excellent interview.
Thank
and
you.
The time has been flying by. Tracy, I just wanted to give you a minute maybe to throw in your two cents here.
Just to continue on with what we were talking about, it just reminded me again of the irony of things like the human will to bring these exotic animals into our urban experience because we feel this loss, this that there's something missing, that we're lacking in this experience with nature, and yet at the same time, through our processes of urbanization, we're driving out any of the animals that actually do live here and exist in our own spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'll just make another point. Just when you were talking about, I agree with you so much about how we've lost our imagination. We've lost our imagination around animals. We need to see them. We need to probe them and make nature reveal her secrets. And I was just wondering, though, you told the story of the rhinoceros, and our imaginations can be fueled by the animal, or the stories we hear about animals, and yet it's so difficult to write about animals in a way that doesn't include human projections or anthropomorphic perception.
Mm-hmm. Randy, we don't have time for you to give a response to that. I'm so sorry. We'll have to have you back on the show.
Okay, anytime.
Because it's so rich, and you have such wonderful things to say. Thank you for being on today.